Hi, welcome to the stream. I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin. Can a human rights campaign during COP27 help release Salah Abdel Fattah? On today's show, I should say, we'll look at the plight of Egypt's most well-known dissident and the solidarity movement for the country's political prisoners. As always, we welcome you to be a part of this conversation by adding your comments and questions in our live YouTube chat. The British-Egyptian pro-democracy activist Salah Abdel Fattah has spent most of the past decade behind bars. He was a major figure in Egypt's January 25th revolution back in 2011. He has since been charged with violating protest laws and spreading false information. And to protest his imprisonment, he has been on hunger strike for over 200 days. Now, Salah is one of more than 60,000 political prisoners in Egypt, a figure denied by President Abdel Fattah Sisi. With us to talk about all of this in London, Mona Saif, a human rights activist and sister of Salah. In Brussels, Hussein Bayoumi, Egypt and Libya researcher with Amnesty International. And in Washington, D.C., Allison McManus, research director with the Freedom Initiative. Thank you all for being with us. Mona, I want to start by asking you, this Friday, the 18th, is the last day of COP27. It's also Salah's 41st birthday. This will be his 9th birthday in prison. I'm wondering how you're feeling today and this week after the culmination of all the events in Sharm el-Sheikh.
It's been a roller coaster, really. The past 2 weeks in particular were the hardest in the few months before, since Salah started his hunger strike in April. The 2 weeks where we had no news of him, he was completely incommunicado, and then he was on water strike, were just a nightmare. But at least we got the note from him yesterday confirming that he has ended his hunger strike. Looking forward to our mother's and sister's visit on Thursday. And actually for the first time in 3 years, asking them to come with the intention of celebrating his birthday. So all is giving us a slightly better feeling about at least his mental well-being. So a part of me is relieved, even though we don't know what happened during these 2 weeks and we don't know what has finally brought Ali to the decision to end his hunger strike. And we are waiting impatiently for the visit to understand how his health is really and what kind of medical care he's been given in prison. So yes, it's been quite a tough and weird trip. But for now, at least, I'm a lot more relieved that we know he's alive. We stopped the hunger strike, and my mother and sister will see him to know more and share with us.
And hopefully, that news comes sooner rather than later. I know it's been very difficult for many people trying to follow this case, which is why we're talking about it today. I want to ask you, Allison, looking at what was happening on the ground in Sharm el-Sheikh. If you look at just this photo, for example, this is one of several protests in a certain area that was sort of made to allow for protests to happen there. They said, you know, there can be no climate justice without human rights. We've seen a lot of solidarity pouring in from around the world. Do you think enough is being done? Are you optimistic? And do you think there's been enough international pressure, specifically from governments that are close to Egypt, like the UK and the US?
Yeah, thanks so much, Ahmed. It's a great question. I mean, as Mona said, it's been a roller coaster. I mean, I'm obviously for Alat's family, but for all of us who work in the human rights movement, on the one hand, we've seen absolutely unprecedented mobilization, unprecedented solidarity that's come from climate justice advocates, from activists like Greta Thunberg, from influencers, celebrities. Literally all over the world, folks have been showing up wearing white, posting messages of solidarity. Literally all eyes have been on Egypt, except when it comes to the world leaders who we really hope are hearing the message. I mean, not just the message when it comes to centering human rights in foreign policy, but a message from their own constituents. I mean, I was in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, wearing white. You know, calling on Joe Biden to say the names of Elat, to say the names of Ahmed Amasha and so many others. And unfortunately, we were quite disappointed and I dare say even betrayed that those messages weren't delivered more forcefully when they had the platform to do so.
And I appreciate you making that point. And Mona, I saw you were nodding as Allison was talking. Hussein, I'll come to you in a moment. But Mona, Why were you nodding? And also, I want to ask you specifically on the point of the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak. Days before arriving to Egypt for COP, he told your sister in a letter that he would do everything to release Ala. And then we saw him dodging the questions. And as we heard from Alison, a lot of people saying not enough is being done. Do you think enough is being done? Why were you nodding there?
I was nodding because, honestly, I feel overwhelmed with the solidarity we've been getting from all over the world. And I feel like everyone is doing more than enough except the governments. Human rights defenders, supporters, people, NGOs, activists, even celebrities, journalists, writers, everyone is doing an amazing job of making the world know and hear more about not just Alaa, but about the tens of thousands of political prisoners in Egyptian prisons. But the governments are failing us miserably. So far, what we have seen, even though more than one of the world leaders, Scholz of Germany and Biden and Macron, and of course Rishi Sunak from UK, all of them mentioned Alaa by name. But all we have seen, whether about Alaa or about other political prisoners, is that the governments talk, but they do not couple their talk with serious action to support their claim and to make sure human rights is a priority. It's not just a point in a checklist to check out. As for Rishi Sunak, I was particularly disappointed because while he promised to do everything to secure Alaa's release, he actually went to Sharm el Sheikh and returned to UK without, at a point where we didn't even know if Alaa was alive. And he didn't even manage to secure us a proof of life or secure consular access to him. So not only didn't he deliver on his promise, right, he failed miserably to provide the minimum.
Right. And, you know, the way you phrase it, they're very critical. A lot of people echoing those criticisms. Hussein, I want to share with you someone who's of Egyptian origin from Australia who sent us this comment. Take a listen to what Nadine Medkur had to say.
I think what the Free Alaa campaign has exposed to many of us is that we can no longer depend on leaders from the West to be the arbiters and the upholders of human rights in the international community. You know, we have the United States providing $1.3 billion in military aid to Egypt every single year. And yet simultaneously on the other side, we have President Sisi boasting about building the largest prison complex in Egypt's modern history, referring here to Wadi Notroun, which was modeled on American-style prisons, and where Alaa Abd El Fattah and potentially other 60,000 political prisoners are being held. You know, of course, the focus now is on freeing Alaa, ensuring that his family are able to visit him, to communicate with him, and that he's not longer being tortured by the authorities. But I think broadly, we need to start asking, who is funding all this?
Hussein, last year, Egypt launched, I believe it was called the National Human Rights Strategy. Amnesty, of course, called this a shiny cover-up to obfuscate, to distract, to deceive the international community. Is it working? I mean, you heard Mona kind of take the prime minister to task for not doing anything. Why would that be happening, in your opinion?
Well, I mean, it's happening for the very simple reasons that politics are, to a large degree, about, like narrow interests of politicians. So from what we have seen so far, that when we saw coordinated public pressure on the Egyptian authorities last year, when we saw a joint statement at the United Nations Human Rights Council from 33 countries, we saw that the Egyptian authorities were very quick to react to that. They have taken a number of limited measures, including the release of a number of political prisoners, lifting the state of emergency. However, these measures have not been meaningful measures to actually reverse or even stop the crackdown or the human rights crisis in the country. What we have then seen after that is that world leaders were quite happy with the limited measures presented by the Egyptian authorities, while refusing to take the necessary measures that should be taken in the context of Egypt. Mm-hmm. I just want to comment also on the on the comments that you shared earlier. I mean, when we raise or when we are calling on the world, the international community to raise concerns about human rights in Egypt or to ensure that human rights are at the cornerstone of their bilateral and multilateral relations with Egypt, or when we ask the international community to establish a monitoring and reporting mechanism on the human rights situation in Egypt, we are not asking them this because they should be or the arbiter of human rights, but because this government in Egypt is also to a large degree. I mean, it doesn't exist in vacuum. It exists also through the support that it receives from the international community,
right.
Through loans, through funding, through arms, and through legitimacy above
yeah.
all.
And
I want please. To comment on the strategy for human rights, please. It's been a year now since it was issued, and the reality is the strategy for human rights made by the Egyptian government was issued to provide another cosmetic change that was done merely for the benefit of the Western community and the Western governments. Mm. If you ask any Egyptians, nothing has changed in the kind of violations they face on a daily basis with dealing with the state, whether in detention facilities or in the street after the strategy was released. But a lot of politicians, foreign politicians, keep on referring to it as if it's an improvement.
Right.
In truth, what's written in it is the same that is written in the Egyptian constitution, and the fact they are all ink on paper, they are not being upheld by the Egyptian authorities in the first place. So it doesn't matter if they produce five more new documents as long as they are breaking the law in practice and in action.
Right, and that's an important... Go ahead, Alison, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to add, I mean, to both of those excellent comments, I think, you know, we've seen sort of both things are true. One, as Hussein said, the very minuscule improvements, the few releases that we have seen, which we celebrate each and every one, have only happened because of the sustained international pressure. The tragedy is that rather than world leaders saying, okay, we need to step that up, we need to demand more, we need to ask for more, this is what our citizens are asking. I mean, that's what I'm asking of my government, what Mona's asking of her government. They're actually saying, okay, that's good enough. That's good enough. Let's back off a bit.
Right.
The day that Biden was in Sharm on November 11th,
yeah.
there were people being arrested in the streets.
Well, and I'm
on that day.
I'm glad you brought that up. I'm glad you brought that up, and forgive me for interjecting, but because you did, I mean, hundreds, I believe, 400 since the beginning of COP have been arrested. I think, if I'm not mistaken, one or two have in fact, or three people have died in prison, you know, due to a lack of medical care. It's impossible to know the details. But I do want to ask you, and forgive me for putting you on the spot, I don't mean this to be in any way silly, Mona, but when you look at this image, if you look at my computer, this image of President Biden and President Sisi exchanging a laugh, you know, walking hand in hand, arm in arm. Meanwhile, we've heard from President Biden himself, as well as other, you know, former U.S. Officials, people like John Kerry, that the U.S. is doing everything they can. Do you believe that the U.S. is doing everything they can, or that the U.K. is doing everything they can when you hear these statements, Mona? And specifically, I know it was strategic to get Ala the British citizenship. Has that, in your mind, proved to be effective at trying to bring more attention to his case and all the political prisoners?
Okay, so for the photo, it just highlights the hypocrisy we have to deal with on a daily basis. Honestly, neither Biden nor Abdel Fattah el-Sisi represent me or represent human rights, nor are they just, you know, presidents who are liable to pressure by the international community and by their own people. And we try and pressure them to uphold the law and to make sure human rights is a priority for each and everyone on this planet. But at the end of the day, they are politicians. They serve their own agendas and they serve their own business deals and their own vision that definitely does not include human rights nor equality and justice for all, regardless of what they say. As for Ali, it was. I'm not sure if a strategic, going through the citizenship paperwork was. I'm not sure if it was a strategic thing rather than our final desperate attempt.
Right.
We've been through this loop for 9 years. Every time Ali finishes his sentence, they come up with a new case and charge for him. And the worst of it is that since 2019, we've been dealing with a level of violence and brutality we have never as a family experienced before. Alec's torture, our beating ups, and his abduction from the general prosecutor's office, like horrific, horrific violations that I would have never thought we'd be exposed to, let alone be exposed to with that intensity and condensation.
Are you talking about in you know, popular discourse and public discourse and social media in Egypt? Is that the kind of harassment? I know there's been an uptake sort of on targeting you specifically and your family. Or what are you referring to specifically?
So the slandering campaigns and the ongoing campaigns on us on social media and on state media are kind of a norm, and you get used to them after a while. They become a noise in the background. But what we have been dealing with actually since 2019 is actual violence, actual brutality and violence. In June 2020, when we were in front of Soura prison trying to get information about Ali after there was no communication with any prisoners because of COVID lockdown on all prisons in Egypt, we were sent a group of thugs who beat us up in broad daylight in front of all the guards in front of Tora. Sanaa was severely beaten up. The next day, when we went to the general prosecutor to file a complaint and to basically ask for his protection, instead of protecting us and instead of opening a full investigation into our assault, he actually allowed state security to abduct Sanaa from in front of his office, and she was taken to state security prosecution and ended up a year and a half in prison. So we are just dealing with the kind of, you know, pressure and slandering we are getting online, but we are actually dealing with continuous physical threats.
And we just shared that tweet referring to that incident where you were bruised and where people, you know, this physical violence, Allison, we shared that with our audience. The reason I share that is because, you know, it's easy to pay attention to this story when the world chooses to pay attention because of COP, but COP is ending soon. And I wonder, not just for Alaa, why do you think, as we heard from Muna, that he specifically has been made a target? Each time he finishes a sentence, there are more trumped up charges. Why are they going after Alaa specifically? What is it about his character and his reputation and what he symbolizes in the context of freedom of expression and democracy in Egypt?
Well, I think it's quite clear. Alaa symbolizes hope. Hope that people could have a say in their governance. Hope that people could have a say in how the economies run. Hope in that people could have a say and how the government deals with climate change. The revolution of 2011 was about hope, and that was something that was clearly felt by millions of Egyptians who came to the streets and millions of people all over the world, including myself. That hope, I think, is the biggest threat that Sisi faces. That's why we see crackdowns when there is any kind of calls for protest. Yeah. And if Alaa is free, I think that everybody knows that's a symbolic sign that hope can win. And I do think that, you know, we still all hold that in our hearts, and he will be free, but yeah.
And maybe hope springs eternal, and it's an important message to remember in the context of those Arab revolutions that came and left so very quickly. Hussein, I saw that you were nodding. I want to play a video comment that we received before coming to you from May Issadani and Aya Hijazi, sort of echoing some of what you just outlined there, Allison. Take a listen.
Alaa Abd El Fattah has come to represent so much of what was special about Egypt's January 25 revolution. He means something to Egyptians who continue to fight for justice, to activists from across the MENA region learning from his example, to technologists who've taken cues from his visionary writing.
He has succeeded to rally international attention, not only around him, but around the human rights abuses in Egypt. So that symbol of hope, that powerful voice, deserves to be free. Alaa Abd El Fattah needs to go home to his son and hold him in his arms. Set Alaa Abd El Fattah free.
Hussein, when you hear that and knowing things like still Khaled Ali, his lawyer, Alaa's lawyer, making three unsuccessful attempts recently to try to visit his client in prison, and, you know, he had gained permission to do so from Egypt's public prosecutor, which is what's so strange. You know, this complete lack of adherence to any sort of rule of law, no accountability. Do you expect that once COP is over, once the world stops focusing on this for as much as they are, that it'll be, you know, more of the same in Sisi's Egypt? Are there any indications that there might be pressure, whether externally or from whomever?
Sure. I mean, just to take a step back, I also want to comment on why. I mean, why I think Alaa and his family are being targeted to that manner. And here I'm speaking more of a mix of Egyptian, but also Amnesty International researcher. I mean, I think, look, the Egyptian regime, I mean, it relies on fear. It relies on making everyone in the country afraid of voicing any sort of opinion. It relies on silencing anyone that dares to stand up. It relies on making everyone that dares to stand up to them as an example, so that they can always be an example to anyone who dares to raise their voice, who dares to dream of a better future, who dares to have hopes for a life where they can feel live freely and safely without repression. I think what Ala, I mean, and his family, I have to say as well, I mean, that the courage that they have shown to a large degree so far is that Ala in particular, I mean, despite all the government's security agents, the torture, the prisons, the, you know, like all of these tools and all of these methods, they have not managed to break his spirit. And I think to a large degree, this is also what is very scary to a government like that of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. I mean, mm-hmm. if he cannot force this fear on everyone, mm-hmm. then, you know, then they know that it cannot continue in that manner. I think really Ala's bravery and his, you know, like he has managed to really recreate this global movement from inside his walls. In a sense, you know, like his jailer has become the prisoner of that. So I think after COP, as COP is going, I mean, Alison was saying, I mean, we've seen hundreds of arrests already, over 600 websites continue to be censored. So the situation of human rights, the human rights crisis in Egypt is bigger than COP. I mean, it will continue to go worse until we see coordinated public pressure from the international community and effective measures to limit and to ensure to impunity in the country.
I appreciate you making those points. Of course, it's worth remembering and reminding our audience that Egypt, I believe, is the third largest jailer of journalists. So there really is very little space for freedom of expression, whether locals on the ground or foreigners. And of course, your sister, Sanaa, was there at COP, Muna. So I want to play for our audience what she had to say to the world. Take a listen.
Whatever way out that is needed, we don't care whether as an Egyptian or as a British, we want way out. We want to walk out of this fight. We've been trying to walk out of this fight for 9 years. He is either dead or hospitalized. So is he hospitalized in that facility? Is he in another facility? We don't know. We need governments to get consular access.
Muna, in all honesty, I wonder, you know, for each of you having been jailed yourself, your sister, your mother, I mean, I wonder how you maintain the stamina, the hope. When Alison said that your brother symbolizes hope earlier, I saw your face sort of a facial expression shift. And I wonder where you find hope. And also, in Egypt's sprawling detention system, which we heard Sanaa talking about, we know there's at least 60,000 political prisoners there. Is it true that families end up having to provide sort of food and other basic items to sustain these prisoners? Is there any more transparency around what's happening inside?
Okay, so first a small correction. Me and my mother were never sent to prison. We were briefly detained before, but
forgive me.
No, it's fine. The thing is, you don't operate on hope. I don't think hope has a lot of space in Sisi's Egypt right now. The reality is, this is a struggle for survival for me, for my family, for everyone living in Egypt. And the only way we can do that is by continuing to at least holding on to our voices and telling our own story and our own narratives, because this is exactly what Sisi's regime wants to squash. I was also thinking about when you were talking now about why Ali is being targeted in such a brutal manner. And I just wanted to point out that it's not just Ali. There are a lot of political prisoners whose Sisi's regime is adamant about keeping them in prison. And I think the main reason behind this is they are obsessed with breaking them, and they cannot fathom how do they still maintain parts of their soul intact despite years of imprisonment. And I think this is really one of the mm-hmm. one of the motivations behind how this regime and how the security apparatus behave. They are intent on breaking people, and they don't understand people holding on to bits of their dignity and bits of their soul against all of this brutality and violence.
And I want to thank you for speaking so bravely, so candidly, and for all of you joining us today. I do want to leave our audience with this tweet that I found quite inspired. Mohammed Sultan posted this to Twitter, saying, this is a picture of him and his father, saying, "For prisoners, birthdays are painful reminders of the years that oppression has robbed them of." And he's turning 35 today, wishing, of course, that for his dad and Ala to be released. This is a story that we're going to continue to cover here, of course, at the stream. I want to thank you, Allison, Hussein, and Mona for being with us. Follow us at stream.aljazeera.com online.